Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us for Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Great to have you here this afternoon. If you're a new listener, welcome. We're glad to have you join us today. We had handle and highlight and have some fun with ministries and highlight a ministry each month here at Faith Radio. And this month, you've probably heard us talk about Compassion International, great ministry, and you've had some experience with that as well, Ted.
Yeah, we do sponsor a girl from Mexico, and it's been great to do the letter writing back and forth. You know, she tells us about what she's learning and how our support is impacting her and getting birthday gifts and Christmas presents, but more importantly, learning about Jesus and growing in her faith. And it's just fun for our girls to communicate with her, and they're kind of growing up together in a sense in that way. So a neat opportunity if you have kids to partner with a Compassion Sponsor Child, change their life.
Because they get letters back and you can send pictures.
Absolutely, yeah. And we have her on our fridge right there, and just remember to pray for her every day as we're able. And then you can do this right now. Just go to myfaithradio.com. It's really easy right there on our main page. Just click on Learn More, the Compassion link, and it'll explain how you can get on board. $38 a month is all it takes.
And you can choose 1, 2, 3, 16 kids.
Yeah,
you can choose as many as you want.
That's right. No limits.
So one of the things I heard from a parent whose children support a child through Compassion is that they actually got to go on a trip, just the parent did, got to go on a trip where they saw some of these kids, and one of the children recognized the dad because they had received so many pictures. And so how neat would that be?
What a moment. Yeah, I'm sure jubilation ensued.
Right. You know, one of the things we don't think about very often when we think about supporting children through Compassion is that we're also supporting their parents, because as a parent, you want to be able to give your kid everything that you possibly can. You don't want them to be in need of anything. And so we're also really helping parents through Compassion who want to give love and need things that their children need. You know, we try to do that a lot here, even in the U.S. We need to be supportive of our parents who are trying their very best to do their best with the resources that they have and the children that they've been given to love and care for. So John Stone Street has kind of a unique approach to how do we support parents who are around us.
Moral outrage is all the rage. For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. How dangerous is it to leave your child unsupervised? Well, statistically, not very. In fact, children are in far greater danger of dying in a car accident than they are of being abducted. But endless media coverage of rare crimes has skewed public perception of what's most dangerous. One unintended consequence of this, we've become unbelievably judgmental of other parents. In a study published in the journal Calabra, researchers found that our perception of how much danger unsupervised children are in depends on our feelings about the parents. When participants were told the parents left their child alone because of an emergency, they downplayed the danger to the child. But when they were told the parent left in order to relax or go see a lover, participants said the child was in far greater danger. In other words, our moral outrage is fickle and doesn't help anyone. Of course, responsible parenting is vital, but we should remember Jesus' words. For in the same way you judge others, you will also be judged. I'm John Stone Street.
Well, some great words from John Stone Street, as always. Well, today we'd like to tackle a tough question that really plagues many people throughout their lifetime. Have you ever wrestled with this question? If God is love, then why is there pain and suffering? Well, what if there was room in your theology for a God who is both fully perfect and perfectly revealed in Jesus, particularly in the love of the cross, and that this Jesus-looking kind of God is always doing everything possible to maximize good and minimize evil in this world? Would that view offer you more hope if you were looking at why there's pain and suffering? Well, today we're going to examine that question of why. In this world that's created by a loving God, there does exist tremendous pain and suffering, but we're going to enter into a story of a 4-year-old boy who left this life way too soon, and of his mother, who was left to reconcile her picture of God with that unfathomable pain of losing her son. My guest today is Jessica Kelly. Jessica's a writer and a speaker. She's a survivor of child loss. She has a BS degree in psychology and a master's degree in counseling and human development. She was born and raised in the South, but she now lives with her husband and her daughter here in St. Paul, Minnesota. She said she's learned to survive this absurdity, the absurdity of long winters, by consuming copious amounts of chocolate, as we all do. And you can find out more about her. You can read about her faith journey and her story at jessicakelly.com. We'll have a link to that on our website as well. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you, Joe. It's so great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. Your story is just obviously heart-wrenching and really didn't happen that long ago.
Right. That's correct. About 4 years ago.
About 4 years ago. And it began with the story of your little boy named Henry. So why don't you tell us just a little bit about Henry and the illness that developed that changed your life?
Sure. Well, in 2012, my husband and I, we found out that our four-year-old son, Henry, had a malignant brain tumor. We got his diagnosis in September, and then he was gone before Christmas. So it was a very sudden and surreal experience. We felt like, I've said before, we felt like 1 minute we're planning his future, and the next minute we're planning his funeral.
And it started out with just some symptoms that many of our kids have, especially in the winters here, that kind of this persistent cold that didn't go away. Talk more about that and what led you to finally think, hey, this is a little bit more serious.
Well, he had, like you said, a lot of symptoms that were small. It wasn't one big red flag. It was a lot of small things over time. So the winter that preceded his diagnosis, there were a lot of ear infections. And so we would put him on antibiotics to help with the ear infections. But then we noticed he was losing his appetite and he wasn't gaining weight quite properly. And that makes sense if you're on antibiotics that upset your stomach because you've had ear infections. But he was also starting to fluctuate in his mood. Well, we thought, well, I guess if you're sick and you're not eating well and you're on antibiotics, you know, your mood's going to fluctuate. And then came some stomach viruses. So he was vomiting and began to sleep more. And, you know, we thought, well, we just have to get to spring. We just have to get past the stomach viruses and the ear infections. And we just have to get him well and get him into these summer months and get over this hump. But then we noticed there was some trembling going on. And at first I thought, well, you know, I get shaky when I have low blood sugar. So it must be that he's on these antibiotics. So he's not eating. And so he's hungry and he's tired and he's moody. And now he's kind of shaky. But this is just, we've got to get over these humps. And the doctors were monitoring him. His weight was steady. It wasn't gaining, but it was steady. Blood tests were coming back normal. And so the collective thought was, we just have to get him to spring. We just have to get to outdoor season. But then the trembling started to intensify. And so it was on a Monday in mid-September that we took him back to his pediatrician. And I remember the pediatrician came into the room and he kind of looked at us funny, like, this little boy looks okay. What do you mean he's trembling? You know, he knew Henry. And so I got Henry down and I put a stool out and I said, Henry, take a step up on the stool for the doctor. And when he tried, he couldn't make it. His legs were shaking so badly. Mm-hmm. So I grabbed him and put him back on the table. I got a lump in my throat that stayed there for days. And the doctor said, well, okay, maybe this is autoimmune. So he ordered some more blood tests just to be safe. He said, let's order an MRI. Maybe it's a pinched nerve. And let's get an appointment with a neurologist. Maybe, you know, next month we'll just get him scanned. We'll just to be safe. But by that Friday, the symptoms had intensified again. And he shook so badly that he couldn't cross the playground equipment at our local playground. And I remember my 2-year-old daughter climbed up the steps on the playground equipment, and she just blew past him. Mm. And I thought, wow, that's extraordinary. And it was so ordinary. But he had just begun to deteriorate. So I had a friend who was an ICU nurse, and I told her, I can't go walking with you today. We always walked on Fridays. I said, because this is what's going on. And the doctor, we're supposed to be back in the doctor's office on Monday. They're going to check in with him again. She said, why don't you go ahead and take him to the Children's Hospital emergency room? And I have never known her to exaggerate or to be overly cautious or anything like that. So it didn't take much convincing. We quickly packed up. My dad came down from Virginia. We were living in Georgia at the time. My husband and I took Henry to the emergency room. We got there and they got us a room very quickly. When you have a child shaking and now his leg was beginning to drag as he walked, they put you in quickly. Mm. But we waited for 6 hours in a little room until midnight on Friday night when the chief neurosurgeon for the hospital was paged. So So the nurses came in and they said, we want to give you some privacy. So when it's a Friday night after midnight and the chief neurosurgeon to the Children's Hospital has been paged to come and speak with you down the hall and you need privacy, you know that's going to be a pretty big moment. Mm. So I just remember looking into the neurosurgeon's eyes and seeing the mistiness in his fatherly eyes as he said, it's a tumor. It's a big tumor on his brain and we need to operate on him and we need to get him well. Mm. And I thought, yeah, let's do that. Let's get him well and let's take him home.
And at this point, you don't know anything about the tumor. You know that it's large. You know that when he says we're going to operate and get him well, that there's a possibility that the rest of your life is going to go on just as planned.
I assumed that it absolutely would go on as planned. It was out of left field. I had no frame of reference for what a brain tumor is like for a child or for even one that massive and that vascular that was woven so into the blood system there in the brain. I thought, okay, this is terrible news, but now everybody's concerned and all these capable people are intensely focused on getting him well. So let's get him well, let's do what we have to do and let's get him home. And so people started praying, people started rallying and they admitted us that night and then he had the surgery 4 days later.
We're going to hear more about Jessica's story and her precious son, Henry. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back to talk about the story of little Henry in Jessica's book, Lord Willing, Wrestling with God's Role in My Child's Death. We'll be right back with Jessica Kelly. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Maybe you've walked through some fires of your own and wondered, where is God in this suffering? And why would God allow people to suffer if he's supposed to be loving and all-knowing? Well, those questions have plagued a lot of people, including my guest for today, Jessica Kelly, as she went through a terrible situation with her little son, Henry. And Henry left this life way too soon. Jessica has put her thoughts into a book called Lord Willing with a question mark. Wrestling with God's Role in My Child's Death. Well, Jessica, you were telling us that Henry was brought into the hospital, and at this point they found out that his strange behavior and illness that didn't seem to get better was the result of a brain tumor that was very large and needed to be removed right away. Mm-hmm. So what happened after that, and what did you find would be really the next several weeks of your life?
Well, we went that Tuesday he had a craniotomy that we knew would last 6 to 8 hours. And so what we were praying for was that they would come back and that they would say, we got it all. Because if they got the entire tumor, his prognosis was much better, that we could go home and live a normal life. And we were also hoping and praying that they would say, it's benign. Because if it was benign, again, we much better prognosis of going home, having a normal life. So I remember that day being at the hospital and trying to pass those 6 to 8 hours. Every hour, someone from the surgery room called us. And every time I remember, I almost dropped my phone and threw up on it. It was just so nerve-wracking to get those updates. But they were very professional, very calm, and very assuring every time. And so we just kept praying. They got it all. It's benign. They got it all. It's benign. That's what we're going to hear. And 6 to 8 hours later, they said, okay, come on upstairs and let's meet. And so my entire family got in the elevator together. Extended family was there. Thousands were praying. They got it all. It's benign. They got it all. It's benign. And my husband and I were waiting in the hallway for the surgeon. And the rest of my family was inside the waiting room with the door closed. So they couldn't see what we were saying. They couldn't hear. They could just see our faces. They could see us hugging the surgeon, and then they saw us enter the room. And I remember just sitting in the middle of the circle of my family members and just staring at a tile in front of me. And this tile was straight, and it was square, and it was firm, and its boundaries were so clear. And if I just kept my eyes on this single tile, I thought maybe I won't have to meet their faces, and I won't have to tell them that they didn't get it all. They only got 50% before he lost 3 liters of blood, which was enough to fill his entire body. And it wasn't benign. It was highly aggressive and malignant. And at that point, we had some excruciating conversations to have and decisions to make. Decisions you never think that you'll face as a parent.
And really, when you heard the options that you had, there was really only one that you felt comfortable with.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that process and how in the world did you even come to realize this is our only option?
Well, being that he was just a few months past 4 years old, the options were much more limited than they would be for an older child or an adult. And given the size and of the brain tumor, the options were limited. So we basically had a low prognosis no matter what, a poor prognosis for his survival no matter what. But the only treatment options were so grueling and aggressive that we didn't have a peace with pursuing those. What we ended up doing after a lot of research, a lot of discussions with medical professionals, a lot of prayer and discussion, was to get him the rehab that he needed to recover from the trauma of a brain surgery and then to bring him home with hospice care. And I remember telling his neurosurgeon that this is what we had decided to do, and he said, "I wish that I could argue with you. I wish I could tell you to keep fighting." He said, "But I can't do it. This is what I would want if I were in his shoes." And you're giving him the opportunity to go home, the dignity to be with his family, to be surrounded by the things that he loves. And so they were very, very supportive. And at that point, we had about 8 more weeks at home with our 4-year-old before he passed.
Oh, Jessica, you write so eloquently about those 8 weeks, and it sounded so hopeful so many times. It sounded so hopeful, like Henry was actually getting better, and you had, this was in the fall, long before Christmas and Thanksgiving, but you wanted to celebrate Christmas because that was his favorite holiday. Tell me just a little bit about those weeks and his demeanor through which you write was really quite outstanding.
Yes, well, when you have a brain surgery, you lose so many of the functions that he had enjoyed. And so as we brought him home and he was surrounded by his little sister that he wanted to keep up with, he wanted to chase her and to catch her. And so he began to run again. He regained that motor ability to begin to run again. And he was on these wonderful medications to manage his pain and his appetite. And so he began to eat and he began to grow. Mm. You wouldn't think a child on hospice care with a terminal brain tumor would grow, but he began to grow and he was running. And he was on a lot of medication. So he was a little bit like Frosty the Snowman. He was kind of bumbling around and knocking into things, but he always had a twinkle in his eye and he had the sweetest demeanor. There was a while that we thought maybe. I mean, thousands were praying. We had a church come and join hands in our backyard. They would circle the house. I mean, we thought maybe there was a miracle. Maybe there was healing. We hadn't seen him tremble since the surgery because the trembling was a result of the hydrocephalus, the pressure on his brain. And when that was relieved, he stopped trembling. And so we thought maybe there'll be a healing.
And yet, As the time went on, then that tumor continued to grow. And so there had to be a point where you had to surrender that. What was that like? And what was going on in your understanding of who God was at that point in time?
Yes, I remember the morning that I woke up and went into the living room. And there's Christmas carols on the Christmas tree that we had decorated in October to celebrate his favorite holiday was lit up. And he reached for the sippy cup and his hand was shaking. And at that point, I knew that the trembling had returned. I looked at my husband and he said, "I see it too." And that's when we knew that he was going to die, that Henry was going to die. And so at that point, the faith transformation that I experienced before Henry ever got sick was something that was invaluable to me because I had wrestled with God's role in pain and suffering before our crisis hit. And I had rejected the idea that everything happens according to a meticulous divine blueprint. And instead, I had embraced the notion that God is always doing everything possible to maximize good and minimize evil within the constraints of the world that he created, that we were doing John 10:10 together, that I was aligned in knowing that the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy, but that Jesus comes to bring life to the full. And having really solidified that meant that when Henry's illness again began to take that turn towards death, that I could fall into God's loving arms without reservation, knowing that we were on the same side.
you know, I want to take some time to unpack that theology. We have about 4 minutes before we come to the break. So if we don't get to all of it, we'll catch up on the other side of the break as well. But it's so common for people who have lost someone or who've gone through something incredibly traumatic to have this crisis of faith where they wonder, well, where is God in that suffering and why in the world would he allow that to happen? And yet you have kind of a distinct perspective on that. How did you come to that understanding of this different kind of theology of what God, who God is and what it means that he loves you?
Well, it starts with basing my picture of God on the person of Jesus Christ. So it really starts with Hebrews 1:3. And I remember when I started to wrestle with my picture of God, just going back daily to make sure that verse was still in my Bible, because it says that in the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son, and that Jesus is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation. The exact representation of his being. And so once I really locked that in, oh, God is, Jesus is the exact representation of God. He's God's selfie, as I've heard it put. Then what do I do with the suffering in the world? Well, I start by asking myself, would Jesus say yes to this? Would Jesus say yes to a malignant tumor, to a child facing an early death? And if I don't think that Jesus would nod in approval over that, then I don't think, based on Hebrews 1:3 and the other verses in the New Testament that define Jesus as representing God's character, that I could believe that God was saying yes to that either. So my picture, my theology, my take on God's role in suffering really starts with that, with a God revealed completely in the person of Jesus Christ.
And this wasn't something that you kind of came to on your own. You had long before you even had children. No, you had the children. But when you had babies, you were kind of listening to some sermons and some podcasts and just getting kind of this conflicting idea of who God was. So how did you come to this understanding of who God is?
Well, I realized in my late 20s and early 30s, while I was up all night with the babies, listening to sermon podcasts, I realized for the first time in my life that there are Christians who love God, love Scripture, follow Jesus, and yet have completely different understandings of God's role in suffering. And so I began to then wrestle with my understanding of God's role in suffering and to look at the assumptions that I had held. And I realized that most Christians hold a blueprint worldview, which is the belief that history is a working out of God's meticulous divine blueprint, and that there's a mysterious higher good behind anything that comes to pass.
So I'm gonna stop you there because we only have a minute left, and I want to get to what this blueprint mentality was, especially for you as you were going through this, and how it didn't reconcile with what you believed to be true about God, and how could that possibly be true? And we'll talk about what other perspective did Jessica have that allowed her to see this suffering not as a divine appointment, but really as a representation of who God is and how he was going to change not only her, but her son and other people through this story. We'll talk more about that with Jessica Kelly and her book, Lord Willing, Wrestling with God's Role in My Child's Death. We'll be back in a moment on Connecting Faith. Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm talking to author and writer and mother Jessica Kelly. She's written a book called Lord Willing with a question mark. Lord Willing? Wrestling with God's Role in My Child's Death. Jessica has told us just a heart-wrenching story about losing her four-year-old son to a malignant brain tumor, and how her faith was questioned not only through that process, but how her faith has been strengthened as well. So Jessica, you were talking about this blueprint view that everything that happens is part of this divine plan and God's just checking off the boxes, whether it's good or bad or whatever. He's just checking those boxes off as things occur. But there are some challenges to looking at pain and suffering specifically through this view. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So the blueprint worldview, and you summed it up well, is the belief that history is this unfolding of God's meticulous divine blueprint. And it comes packaged in two forms. So the strong form of the blueprint worldview is the belief that God planned everything, even the bad things, to happen as part of a blueprint to bring him glory. And the weak form is the belief that God doesn't necessarily cause the bad things to happen, but that he specifically allows them for a mysterious higher purpose. And an illustration that I use in the book of this would be like a father standing by a family swimming pool as his toddler drowns. So in the strong form of the blueprint worldview, the father is the one who pushed him in or makes sure that he falls in. And in the weak form, the father never touches the child, but he still fails to intervene as the child creeps near the edge and overreaches for that bobbing beach ball. Now, in either case, this blueprint worldview that I used to hold leaves us with several questions, such as, if this is God's character, how can I ever trust him? How does this view of God reconcile with the God revealed in Jesus, who healed the sick and raised the dead and did everything he could to bring life to the full? If this is love and God is love, what does love even mean? So these are some of the problems that I see with the blueprint worldview. And in transitioning to a warfare worldview, my faith was better equipped to handle this tragedy because I rather believe that God's will is not the only will that determines what comes to pass, that there's a multiplicity of wills that affect what happens, and that all evil ultimately originates in wills other than God.
So if there's this multitude of wills going on, how does that measure with the sovereignty of God? How can you explain that? And who is it that he's having war with? And are we in that war?
Such a great question. Sovereignty is such a key issue. And so I dedicate an entire question to that in the back of Lord Willing to get into the nuances of it. But I think that a lot of us are accustomed to thinking of sovereignty as meticulous control over whatever comes to pass. And the problem with that is when we view God as meticulously controlling every detail, we rule out the possibility of love. Because 1 Corinthians 13 tells us love does not insist on its own way. It can't be forced. It must be chosen. And so when God creates beings that can freely choose love or reject love, then we see that he's not created something that he meticulously controls. Ian and I, we wanted to expand our love. And so we had children that could accept it or could reject it. We took a risk in having children because we didn't know for sure that they would return our love when they were adults, but we hoped that they would. If we wanted to meticulously control everything that happened, we would have gotten a doll that said, I love you, when we pull a string on its back. But we wanted to have a real, authentic relationship. And so I think we can look at God's sovereignty, his ruling authority, in terms of his love, in terms of the cross. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1 that the cross is the wisdom and the power of God. And that doesn't make sense to a lot of us. But I think when we see God flex his omnipotent muscle, we see a God getting crucified at the hands of his enemies out of love for his enemies. And we learn to rely then, I've learned to rely then, on a God of creativity, a God of wisdom, a God of sacrifice, and a God of unfailing love.
So when we look at God's love in this way, where he loved us, he took a risk in creating us, that risk allowed for this rejection that might take place, and that allowed for this multitude of wills, but that God is still always with us. How did you start looking at verses like Romans 8:28, which seems to be this almost cliche that is given to people who have lost someone or something? How did you look at that differently with this worldview versus the worldview of a blueprint?
And I'm so glad you brought that verse up. I go into detail about that in chapter 10 of the book. And that is such a key verse because we're accustomed to looking at Romans 8:28 through a version like maybe the New Living Translation that says God causes everything to happen. He's working it all out for our good. But there are other versions of the Bible that say that God, in everything, God is working with us to bring about good. And the verb that's in question there is the word from which we get our word synergy. And so I talk about a scholar in the book who says that verse isn't about God working various ingredients together. It's about God working together with us to bring good no matter what comes to pass. And I think that's what's been the most exciting part of embracing a warfare worldview for me, is that I know that no matter what comes to pass, God will meet it with purpose. He will meet that pain with purpose. Some people say, well, if God didn't plan my pain, then it must be meaningless. Mm. God had to have planned it for it to have purpose. And to them, I would say, I don't believe that Henry suffered and that Henry died at 4 years old because God planned for that to happen. But I believe that God meets that pain with purpose at every corner.
So how did adopting this warfare view, which was long before Henry was diagnosed anyway, but how has it allowed you to see God's love now that you're going through not only what you went through with Henry, but what you're going to go through really for the rest of your life as you grieve his loss?
Well, rather than trying to accept that this is somehow meant to teach me a lesson or that I'm supposed to somehow be better now that my child has died the way I would have struggled to do under a blueprint worldview, rather than trying to figure out how to thank God for this terrible thing, instead I'm able to really call it evil, call it a tragedy, and to be able to then welcome those moments when I see good being brought to it as being from God. The other day, I was getting my daughter ready for back to school. And every time we go into a transition now, I'm reminded of the transitions that I had with Henry. And I wanted to get him ready for back to school. I wanted to buy him new shoes and a new backpack, and I couldn't do it. So I was having a really rough night. And I remember in prayer and with my husband just crying and pouring out my heart. And in the morning, I had all of these messages through social media channels from people saying, I've just encountered your story for the first time. And boy, is it bringing me closer to God. Or I just gave your book to someone who really needed it, and you should have seen the look on her face. And so what sustains me moving forward is that I can welcome those instances as being from the God that I recognize, a loving God who creatively meets me and brings purpose to this pain.
You know, I'm glad you brought up prayer, because that was something that is so important as we come in contact with people who have lost someone or who are praying for something to happen. And with this worldview, the warfare worldview, we are participants in this process of prayer, in communicating with God, where some people might say, well, prayer is just a way to really change our hearts. And so it's God's not going to change. It's just a way to change us. But how do you respond to that?
I would say Jesus encouraged us to pray that God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven, which assumes that it's not. That very statement presupposes that his will is not always being done on earth as it is in heaven. And so I think just as we've been given free will to decide what we're going to do each day, and that's our say-so in how we live our lives in this physical realm, that prayer is our degree of say-so in what happens in the spiritual realm. And so I think in this view, prayer is dynamic and it's powerful and it has the ability to affect change.
It's just such an encouraging way to look at communicating with God, and how when we are going through something, to gather people in prayer, to have them participate in this process, and that this view of who God is really allows for that. So as you come in contact with, I'm sure you do, people who have really had this crisis of faith and have given up on God, how do you encourage them?
Well, I've heard from people who have said that when they believe that their tragedy happened according to God's perfect plan, they shut a door, they walked away, or they found themselves bound by anger and by resentment. And so the most meaningful feedback that I get from the book is the letters of people that say, I'm taking baby steps back, or I'm taking a full breath now. Or when people tell me that God loves me, it doesn't feel like an insult anymore, because I can really make sense of that.
It does seem that sometimes we don't know what to say. And so the answers that some people may give really hurt more than they help. What can you tell people what can we say to those who are going through a significant loss, and how can we encourage them and still be encouraging of who God is?
I think that there are three points that I like to keep in mind when someone's hurting. And the first is that if someone's theology doesn't line up with our own and they're in the midst of trauma, don't challenge them. Mm-hmm. Allow them to fall back into the beliefs that have always sustained them and go through that trauma with the beliefs that they're holding tight to. Because we'd never want to compound someone's crisis with a crisis of faith. So to be really sensitive to what I like to say, the victim drives the theology car. So being mindful of that victim and letting them drive their theology car. The second thing I would say is to avoid blueprint explanations. Even those who hold the blueprint worldview will often say, don't give explanations, because we don't need to hear in the midst of a trauma, God knows what he's doing. I mean, that ultimately means that whatever's happening is going to be for the best, and that's not always the case. So avoiding those blueprint explanations, I think, is key. And I think a third thing that I get really excited about, and the reason I wrote the book, one of the main reasons I wrote the book, was if we can have these conversations about God's role in suffering today, then our faith is better equipped for tomorrow's pain. We're better able to organically draw from the shared conversations that we've had with one another about what God's role is when it comes to pain and suffering. And there were, you know, I have an example. There were a couple of women in my church that I attend, and they had heard me give a sermon, which the book is based upon, on this topic. And they hadn't heard really it laid out like that before, so they processed it for months together. Whenever they got together, they would talk about it. Well, you know, what does that mean for this or that? And then one of those women met with tragedy. And she tells me they were better able to remind one another of what they had wrestled with, of what they had learned. They were organically better able to weather that tragedy without the anger, without the resentment of wondering why God would plan that for her. And so their conversations organically stemmed from the work that they had done. And so that's what I get excited about, is that people can wrestle today so that their faith is better equipped for tomorrow's pain.
Sure. And to ask questions now, because then it might make a little more sense than once you're in that journey of pain that you're going through, to be able to rely on. You've already talked about it. You've already wrestled with it. And it does seem like it would make it a little bit more palatable.
It's what allowed me to fall into God's arms without reservation when Henry died. I had wrestled with my picture of God, and I fully believe that he was on the side of bringing life to the full, that he wasn't behind the tumor that destroyed my son's life.
Well, and as I read through the book, of course, we have the advantage of knowing the end story. But to think about those people that were put in your life to specifically encourage you to wrestle with that element of faith, your friend who was a nurse who encouraged you to go, the people that he will continue to put in your life that will support and encourage you. And it just cements the fact that we worship such a warm and living and wonderful God who emulates exactly who Jesus is.
Yes, absolutely.
So you told that message so well, and I just thank you for putting it into words. And for people who want to learn more about you or hear the sermon, I think you have those on your website as well. Can you tell us how to find those?
Sure. My website is jessicakelley.com, and that's K-E-L-L-E-Y. And so there's some posts there. There's information to the book and some videos. And I love to hear from people that are wrestling, that are questioning, that are reading. And so I welcome any of the contact.
Oh, that's wonderful. So again, I'm talking to Jessica Kelley. She's written this book called Lord Willing, Wrestling with God's Role in My Child's Death, for something that's going to challenge the way that you think about God. Something that's going to encourage you if you're going through a time of tragedy, or just to prepare you for that time of tragedy that may eventually come sometime in your life. This is just really a wonderful read and some great things to think about. So thanks so much, Jessica, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful to have you there. And as we continue to think about just what Jessica said today, we just have a wonderful song to give us some time to think about that.
It's the moment when humanity is overcome by majesty, when grace is ushered in for good, and all our scars are understood, when mercy takes its rightful place, and all these questions fade away, when out of our weakness we must bow, and hear you say it's over now. I'm alive, and even though part of me has died, you take this heart and breathe it back.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us today. Boy, just a difficult subject today, but a challenging one, because I love subjects that make you think about why you believe what you believe. Mm-hmm. And I think this was such a great testament to that. And, you know, being a parent, to think about what it must be like to lose a child and then your view of God within that. It's just very moving.
It really is. And I just am so grateful for Jessica being able to share her story the way she continues to, you know, and there's power in the testimony. There's powers in the story. And I just, you know, I'm great that she came in and did that today, because I'm sure it impacted somebody out there.
Sure. And we didn't even finish most of this. I mean, there's more story to be told too, but we only have, you know, an hour show. So I encourage you to get the book and learn more about it and read.
Carissa, what hit you today in the interview?
I would just, Jessica's reminder of, you know, looking at God's heart and knowing his sovereignty by looking at his love. And, you know, just that when tragedy happens in our lives, to not be so quick to blame God, but to just really dig deep into where this what purpose that he can meet us with us and work on, you know, and there has to be a purpose. And so we just turn to the heart of God and press into our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ and just really lift it up together.
What always makes me think about what I say to people too when they're going through a loss.
Yes.
And how you can really either help or hurt someone with, and Jessica said that so beautifully, that you don't want to hammer them with your theology or your opinion. You let them, I think she said, you'd let them drive that theology bus.
Right. And I think, you know, obviously it's always with good intentions where, well, if we get them into the word and point them to this verse, then God will work through that. And yeah, maybe, but just take a minute to think before you speak, I think, is a good thing to take away, definitely.
Right.
I've heard also to just be present, you know, just to be there and to be listening and, you know, to not have the explanations that we try to come up with, because just like Jessica was saying, there's no blueprint. You know, God, some questions just we can't answer for people. And so we can just be with them and pray with them and just try to wrestle with these tough questions together. Mm-hmm.
You know, we had another mom on a while ago. Her name is Angela Waite, and she also lost a young child in an accident at their home. And she had a lot of great things to say as well about that grieving process and the hope and encouragement that she gets through Christ.
One thing you write about in your book is just how everyone heals in a very different way. Everyone goes through grief in a very different way. And you even experienced that with your own family members. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes. You know, my first, I guess the first part of that journey for me was denial. Joe, I kept thinking I had convinced myself that something horrible had happened to me personally. I was in a coma. I mean, I played that through my mind. I had convinced myself that surely God would not ask me to walk this out. So this can't be true. So I did that for probably 7 days. I even went through the funeral thinking I'm going to wake up. In a few days, I'm going to wake up. This is not possible. So I went through denial. My husband went through anger. And the beauty, and those are healthy, that's the healthy processes. But the beauty of that, I believe it's God's grace that he and I were never grieving at the same stage at the same time. That's his grace. Because, you know, if we had both been in the same stage, we could not have cared for our other children. And we were walking them through it, and we were all in different places. And so I love how he's so into the details of our walk, whether it's grief or whether we're on the mountaintop. He's in those details.
And he does know which stage each of those people are in, doesn't he?
He does.
And meets us in that place.
He does. I love that.
One of the things that I have found to be true, and I know that you have too, because you wrote a lot about it, is that we as people who are trying to support those who've lost someone that we love, we don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. We find ourselves doing the wrong thing and saying the wrong thing, things that can actually be hurtful. Can you talk a little bit about what is the best thing to say or do to help someone who's hurting and who's lost someone they love very much?
Yes. You know, as women, we are nurturers. And Joe, I need you not to cry. This is who we are. I want to put a Band-Aid on whatever your crisis is right now, and I need you not to cry. I want to help you, and I want you to smile, and I don't want your mascara to run. And this is who we are as women. And so what happens, this is what I found personally, because people want me to be okay. They can't handle my suffering. And this is, I'm talking about the church. I need you to be okay. And so what we do is I give you something soft. I give you something fluffy and sweet. And what I really needed was truth. I needed someone to remind me, put their hands on my cheeks and say, he's right here. He's right here.
Such a great reminder, both from Angela Waite and also from our guest for today, Jessica Kelly, about the presence of God, that even when we are suffering and at our worst point, he has not left us, that he is there right next to us, whether it's through another person or through his own presence of the Holy Spirit. Just such a great reminder today. So I encourage you to head to our website at myfaithradio.com. If you just click on Connecting Faith, we'll have a link there to Jessica Kelly's website and her book, Lord Willing. And next week, we have some great things in store as well. It's MEA coming up. So on the next Connecting Faith, veteran educator Cynthia Tobias reviews the four basic learning styles for children and how we as parents can work together with teachers to bring success in school and at home. So some great information, some practical information coming up there. And we also have podcasts, of course, available at our show at Connecting Faith.
Yep. Go to myfaithradio.com. The program tab is on the left-hand side. Just scroll down to Connecting Faith, click on that, the show page, you'll find all these wonderful podcasts and interviews right there.
Mm-hmm. We'll keep you company no matter what you're doing on your days off or in the car. And please feel free to check our ministry highlight partner for this week, Compassion International. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week on Connecting Faith.